This is the ongoing story of a loving wife and mother of three, who seemingly vanished into thin air on New Year's Day. A wife who stood by her husband through good and bad, and a wife who would eventually become victim to the evil within that relationship. This is the story of Anna Walsh and the ongoing search for justice. This is Finding Anna.
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any breaking updates and discussions on the case as we have them. Today, we're going to be sitting down and having a conversation about the impulse and the premeditation and much more about the Anna Walsh murder and the allegations against Brian Walsh. The conversation we are going to have today with Robin Drake. He's a retired FBI special agent, chief of counterintelligence and behavioral analysis. And behavioral analysis is part of the expertise that we're really going to be honing in on today. Welcome, Robin. I love having you on because you know this world so well. When we're looking at this case and we're looking at premeditation, we're looking at the thought process that may have been going on in the mind of Brian Walsh leading up to January 1st. We've heard stories from friends, guests of them who had a lovely New Year's Eve just hours before the alleged murder of Anna Walsh with no signs of any sort of trouble, more or less murder that would be taking place just a few short hours later. And then the Google searches that we see that he did literally starting at around 4:55 a.m. How long before a body starts to smell, how to stop a body from decomposing, and then just a few more. And how long to a body can be missing before getting inheritance. Are we looking at something here where he was planning this out for a long period of time, or do you feel something happened, I don't know, purposefully, unexpectedly? That's all still up in the air. But I get the vibe that this was not something he had necessarily plotted out for quite some time, judging by the frantic searches.
You hit all the key points I was cluing in on as well. You know, it was looked from the outside looking in, just knowing what we know from the media. It looks like an escalation of wanting to get out of marriage. It looks like someone that actually had a mindset of criminality. And also I believe there's some reports of, you know, violence reported, or at least, you know, bad tempers and things like that. So you have someone who we go back to that wound collector feeling like a victim, and they're going to seek retribution. And the difference between this, and I was looking at this, someone asked me the other day, compared to the Idaho cases where you have the Ford murders and how that individual, the suspect, was a predator in that one. And yeah, there's a stark difference, you know. In this case, all of a sudden, you see all these searches on the internet. All of a sudden, you see all these horrendous searches on the internet. So obviously, it wasn't planned ahead of time how to dismember and get rid of a body or life insurance or anything like that. So it looks like an after the act type of thing. The other thing that was striking to me, too, is the lack of sophistication. Mm-hmm. Knowing that, all right, they're going to be looking for my searches. They're going to be doing all these things. And so a few things enter my mind on that one. In a lot of these cases where you do have murderers and people with severe predatory behaviors, one thing that helps them tip over the edge is some sort of substance abuse at the time, you know, that kind of lowers their inhibitions and deregulates their brain. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you look at the hour of the night, I think some of those searches were conducted. You look at the stupidity, really, of what he was doing. There didn't seem to be a lot of thought in there. Those are all just things that weigh in my factoring, is that, you know, there's probably more going on there, him chemically, potentially, than just, hey, whoops.
What's amazing to me is that level of stupidity that seems to reign with someone like this, but what they're able to get away with for so long. And how it was not necessarily called out until something extreme happened, such as with the art theft and things of that nature. Are you ever surprised at the level of stupidity in people like Brian that you've investigated?
Sometimes. And it's one of those things, luckily, dumb people do dumb things, and so we're able to get them pretty rapidly. What's the real shame in a lot of these cases is when you go back far enough, this kind of goes what we're talking about with the other case too, you can generally see how someone was made. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, aside from, again, as Chris Mahoney says, broken brain type stuff with chemical imbalances and malformations and things like that, but the behavior type things that someone is typically exposed to on both sides, both as victim and as predator at a young age, is generally really heart-wrenching because they start learning antisocial behaviors and how to cope with situations that is completely inappropriate, and then it just escalates. And then if they're especially these horrible cases where they're surrounded by people that are trying to look the other way. They think they can save someone, or they're just enabling them to continue these inappropriate behaviors. Then it continues to escalate. But what most of these people need is a lot of intervention at a lot younger age on both sides.
What makes people like this attractive to others? And I'm not necessarily saying specifically Anna to him. I'm saying more so as a whole. Yes, romantically, but also circle of friends. Because this is, Brian was someone who wasn't as isolated as like a Koberger, who really kind of seemed off to himself. And people could say, there's something kind of off about him. Not necessarily murderer up until that point, as far as we know, but just kind of off. Walsh, not so much. He had a circle of friends. He had people that enjoyed being around him. What are these people portraying that makes them an attractive friend or lover in things like this?
Hard to say with every individual because there's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of different things with personality. And I'm definitely not, not a licensed psychologist on this one, but as a behaviorist, there's three guarantees in life. And if you can bond on one of these, you're going to have a circle. One is we're all born. The latter is that we're all going to die. And somewhere in the middle, we're all going to have perceived trauma. We're always going to have an experience that impacted us in a traumatic way in our lives. And if people can identify and feel like they're connected, feel like, hey, they're just like me, they experienced trauma too, and you can share those experiences, those can be very bonding things. And so if you have a wound collectors tend to find other wound collectors so they can commiserate together and say how the world's out to get. I'm not saying that's what happened in this situation, but that's how someone with a negative mindset on the world can really be attractive to other people because likes attract likes.
When we're looking at the future of this case and in prosecuting it, in your opinion, do you think Brian has a leg to stand on after making the internet searches, after all the blatant evidence, a bloody knife found in the basement, the back of his car having the tarps? I mean, the list goes on and on. Right. Is this something that really needs a lot of investigation, or is so much of this just on the surface that's so damning?
You never want to take anything for granted when you're having an investigation or doing a prosecution, because the second you get lazy is the second that, you know, a individual should be put away for a long time, if not worse. Mm-hmm. So you never, they should always do a very thorough investigation to thoroughly flush out all these things, because defense will. Mm-hmm. When someone's life is on the line, they will do all they can to, sow a seed of doubt with anyone in a jury if they're pleading not guilty. Because that's what's important in this. But with all this evidence and his lack of forethought, and looks like it was pretty impulsive and not well thought out. Yeah. He left a trail of destruction around him and evidence around him. I think is going to be difficult for him and defense to ever overcome.
When individuals have this level of recklessness in them, whether it be the Brian Walshes of the world, or if we go back up to the first case that we're talking about with Alex Murdaugh, as a behavioralist, is there a level in any of these people where they do want to get caught because the chaos of their life is just so extreme, it's so damaging on a deeper level that they're almost trying to get out of it, and the only way to get out of it is to face the music of their actions?
In some, I would say yes. In others, no, and never. And each of these is really different. Each individual is very different. And the only thing you can kind of draw a little bit of an example here. If you look back at the Idaho murders and the predator in there, I always try not to use the names of the horrible individuals. Okay. But if you look back at his text messages when he was a teenager, he knew he was in pain and he knew something was off. Mm-hmm. That's someone who is doing things in his life to feel things, to have an emotion because he's never experienced one before. So individuals like that are doing it for a lot different reason than you say someone that, you know, snapped and might have had too much to drink and kills his wife, as opposed to someone who's habitually for his entire life ruled and thinks himself above the law. So you have three really kind of different individuals here with different motivations. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say, you know, what their motivation. Now, if we take, now here's an interesting one to bring into it. If you go to the nightclub shootings, well, the dance hall shootings in California, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's that, what was it, 72, 73 year old committed
that,
and
yeah.
then he committed suicide afterwards. That's another different kind of situation as well. Now, there's someone that looks like he might have been trying to get out of a situation, had no hope, had no future, didn't see any other way, and I'm going to off. So, again, one very different situations in them all. Same outcome with a trail of tragedy around them, of lives destroyed, but very different.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I'm curious to touch on the Coburg, the Idaho murder for a second. With that, it's a question I asked someone yesterday as well. Is it something where an individual, they can't feel, they don't feel, they're always trying to emulate those around them to fit into society, but do they find some sort of joy or just some sort of literally feeling in general? The only thing that makes them feel anything is an extreme behavior, such as murder, and that's what drives them to do that, not necessarily because they want to kill people, because that is the only thing that makes them feel anything other than just kind of this baseline emotion of nothingness.
I totally agree. Yeah, if you spend your entire life and you're aware enough to know that I'm not feeling anything, and that seems to be a bit different than everyone else around me, you're going to keep experimenting with things that might get an emotional response in you. And as you're escalating things that might trigger an emotional response, and then you're also a wound collector that's feeling slighted by a particular group, organization, or individual, you're going to seek to give yourself an emotional response or satisfaction. So I'd imagine that following him murdering those four, that he might have had the first time an emotional response that he's ever had. Again, pure theory, pure conjecture.
Of course. Thank you for your insight. Always a pleasure to have you on and get some of your expertise on a case like this. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of Counterintelligence and Behavioral Analysis. Coming up on the podcast in one of our next episodes, we're going to be talking about DNA and really kind of go deeper into that. Reports have come out that Brian Welsh's DNA found on a Tyvek suit found in the trash, including the hacksaw, the hatchet. Prosecutors have been saying that, and we've known that now for about a week. But how does that process of identifying DNA work from a lab perspective? There's lots of internet sleuths or experts, quote unquote, out there that'll tell you, here's how this testing works, here's how this should work. We're going to hear it from the mouth of someone who works in those labs themselves. In fact, someone who worked in the very lab that did the testing in the Brian Koberger case. Carol Murren, going to be joining us on one of our next episodes to go through all of that and give us some very interesting insights. So be sure to press subscribe to not miss that episode and any of our other breaking updates and discussions on this case as we have them. That's going to wrap it up for now. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. And be sure to press subscribe on this podcast just to not miss any of those updates. You can get a commercial-free experience through Apple Podcasts right now and even try that for 3 days free. Until next time, for all of us here at Finding Anna, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.